Dear Mom, I know you've tried to protect me from who I am, and you've said my life before you adopted me doesn't matter, but it does matter. It matters because I still have visions of the place where I was born. I've heard all the whispers. I know what happened in that town where I was born. And I know you've tried to protect me from its horror for 19 years. Well, today I'm going back to that little abandoned town called Gatlin. Home to the truth. Love, Hannah.
Welcome to Percolated Media's Children of the Corn series, part of the Three Men in a Retrospective's look at the film adaptations of author Stephen King.
Give yourself. It's his will.
Join Garrett.
Don't underestimate the power of my vision.
Matt.
He speaks to me always, but today he is displeased.
And Adam.
Is this how they come to a complete stop in California?
As they find out who of the three of them really agrees with he who walks behind the rose.
He who walks behind the rose will decide your fate.
Will the three podcasters survive this trek through rows and rows of corn?
I got your eternal flame right here!
Find out next. Courtesy of Percolated Media.
Come on, let's go!
He Who Walks Behind the Rose, we podcast for you, continuing with Children of the Corn, Genesis, released August 30th, 2011, and this is directed by Joel Sisson. And boys, if that name sounds familiar, we mentioned it a couple weeks ago when we discussed Revelation. This guy was on as a producer, and here he has moved all the way up to writer and director of a film that follows a movie that had somewhat of a positive response to it. We're going back to the origins here. Matt, you said previously that you were dreading the name Billy Drago. Well, here he is. Why were you dreading Billy Drago, and did that really deter your hatred already coming into this particular film?
Because I always thought he was a terrible actor.
Okay.
And honestly, between The Untouchables, when he gets thrown off the roof, that was the highlight of the movie because he was out. And then I saw Takashi Miike's movie Imprint, and he was abysmal and sunk the whole thing, even though there was a lot of stuff in there that I liked.
I did not see Pale Rider, but he was in that. Did you see that one?
You're asking the Clint Eastwood fan if you've seen Pale Rider? Yeah, don't hate that.
So, Adam, after last week's film, were you at all looking forward to continuing this series? Would you think there'd be anything more positive that we could talk about this series with this particular film? Going back to the Genesis.
In a word, no. Especially when I learned that this is just a way for Dimension to keep rights. I hate rights grabs. There's nothing good other than just, we're going to do the absolute bare minimum so that we don't let someone else have it. I resent that in the way of a studio money laundering bullshit way that they do. I just wanted it to be done. If you don't care, give it to somebody else.
There were some positives here. This was around the time when Dimension was doing the Dimension Extreme releases, which I remember very well. You know, there's a movie they released called Inside, which is one of my favorite little foreign horror films from back in the mid-2000s. And I was kind of looking forward to seeing what Joel Sisson could do with this, because I know he had a little bit of a passion for this. He really did like this story, and he wanted to do good things with it. But you know what? After going through the direct that we did, although last week's film gave me a little bit of hope that maybe there's something positive that can come out of it, but we're going back to the drawing board. We're going to be doing another new story based on this concept, and I wasn't sure how that would be pulled off. Anyway, without further ado, we're going to go right into this story. So we start off 20 miles from Gatlin in 1973 as a naval officer named Cole comes home and sees kids around his house. He sees a welcome home sign as well as party favors and food, but none of his family and friends. The record player's going, and there's a finger in the lemon water as his mom falls in a heap off the wall. Another glass breaks, so he pulls out his gun and sees someone holding the Genesis page from the Bible. He explores the house more as a bag moves, and a zombie kid pops out of it and runs away. He then sees what I'm assuming is his girlfriend on the ground. He asks the girl if she did this, and she responds with profits from He Who Walks Behind the Rose. She stabs him, and as he backs up and puts the gun to his chin, she just knocks him out the window. He opens his eyes and sees the kids surrounding him, and that, my friends, is the pre-title sequence. And you know what? I really like this. I thought this was a good way to start the story.
I'm glad you did.
Wow.
You know why? Because this is Genesis. What you're telling me by giving me that subtitle is you're going to explain where and how all this comes. This is the Genesis. This is the first book in the Bible. Instead, we're 1973. We're 20 miles outside of Gatlin. So we're not telling a story of how this all came to be. And as much as I can appreciate dude showing up in his Class B's home for, you know, tie a yellow ribbon around the tree, I'm like, hey, I recognize some of this, until he gets to a loaded pistol already sitting in his duffel bag. This seems like ripoff of bad versions of The Grudge. They're trying to do something here, and it feels like all they did was take stuff that was done that was already old 10 years before this was being done. So if right off the bat, I'm just like, fuck, it's not what I thought I was going to have.
Oh, wow. All right. I had a little bit of positivity. Adam didn't. Matt, where do you land here?
I land more so on your side. I thought at least I could see some roots of horror in this opening, which is pretty high marks considering the bar this franchise has found itself at. But I do think this title, or the subtitle in particular, is a bit misleading.
This, to me, reminded me of all those X-Files pre-title sequences, where we're starting off with a little bit of a grabber, just to kind of get us introduced to who we're going to be following for this film. Although, the thing about this is, we don't follow these characters after this. But I thought it was a good way to start. I really did like this.
Don't we? I think we might. Okay. I don't know. I don't think this movie knows.
One thing that really made an impression on me is, as I'm watching the effects, we have a company named Glowgun doing the effects here. Glowgun, which didn't really go on to be Industrial Light and Magic type effects crew. But anyway, a music box is within frame as credits go by, and then the doors on it as it closes. Now, Adam, you had really bad things to say about the Revelation titles. Did you like the way this title sequence was done?
A little better. It feels fine for the time. It does feel, though, just, you know what? It feels a little better than some of their other direct-to-movie titles they've done.
We cut to the California desert in the present day as a couple squabbles about being stranded and not seeing a car for hours. Steam covers the telephone poles, and when he says he's going to go try call someone for help, we learn that she is pregnant. Wonder if this is going to play into the story.
Is a woman ever allowed to throw up in a movie without her being pregnant? The only thing that was surprising is that they give us all of 30 seconds before they tell us she's pregnant. I thought they were going to hold that reveal.
They knock on the door of a shed with a cross on it, and it opens to reveal a preacher played by Matt's favorite actor, Billy Drago.
Yeah, this is the guy you cast, your charismatic preacher.
Who's unfortunately no longer with us as of 2019, but yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot of these films, like what they do is they pull out one actor who's notable for different things, and then they just kind of give him a small role. Although in this film, he doesn't have a small role. He actually has a pretty big one. He's not Michael Ironside in this. He's not David Carradine in this. He's in the majority of this film.
He's really attempting to do his best Michael Parks, is what he's trying to do, who had a late, you know, career resurgence before his passing.
They ask to use the couple asks to use the phone, and he responds that he has no phone. He then says it's very far to the next neighbor. Allie says that she wants to talk to the tweaker with a shotgun, as she calls him, and he shuts and then opens the door to say that if he left them out in the heat, it wouldn't be Christian of him. Tim and Allie introduce themselves, and they meet Helen and Preacher, as he's called. Helen says that she's been in the States 6 years, and Tim asks what do they watch now that The Sopranos is dead and buried. Which was a funny
I got
that
reference. Yeah. I'm on season two, everybody. It's a decent show. I hope it catches on.
Ask Adam. He avoided it for 25 years.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I finally finished Game of Thrones. Now I'm on The Sopranos. Finally.
HBO knows what they're doing. He goes to give her money for letting them use the phone, and she says not to tell her husband. She then asks for either pot or a cigarette. It's just so funny. We're seeing Billy Drago here, and then, of course, we're seeing this chick that's with him, who, of course, this looks like a kidnapping with these two. You know that there's something up with this couple.
There's at least, you know, a little bit of you don't know what's going on. You don't know who's playing who. And I didn't recognize her at first, and I did have to pause the movie and bring up IMDb. And I'm like, ah, oh, fuck, Hostel. There we go. That's where I know we're from.
Allie tells Preacher that they're going to see Tim's grandfather as he's not doing so well. She says that this is the second time she's been pregnant, but she's confident that this time will go well because it just feels different. Yeah, sure, honey. You're in a Turn of the Corner movie. It's not going to go well. Helen sneaks up on time as he's making his phone call as Preacher damn near coughs up a lung. Allie takes a sip and thinks that she saw someone else, and he responds that heat will do that to you. So Adam is kind of taken in by this us being somewhere where we've never been before. There's kind of some intrigue going on. We don't know what's going on. Matt, were you at least taken on by what they're building here?
Only because it has the seeds, or the kernels, if you want to be that punny, of the first movie where it's a couple driving. after they get stranded and they get kind of get swept up. It's, you know, the wrong place at the wrong time. So I like that connection. I'm not hating it at this point. I'll say that.
Helen is not up for giving Tim personal space as she just seduces him. Tim hears how much it'll cost to fix his car as he gets off the phone, and Allie says that it's hard to get sweet iced tea in SoCal. And as somebody who's lived there, I can vouch for that. Tim gives the options as a local garage is closed on Sundays, and the option of towing them costs $900 plus Sunday charges. Helen says Pritchett could give them a ride to Burleson in the morning at 7. Tim says that he hates to be a burden, and Helen responds, "That's what our Lord commands."
So this franchise commands, too.
They have a very nice dinner, as Allie says that she became a vegan some years ago, as the wind blows pretty hard outside. Preacher points them to the spare room and then says that Helen needs to do the dishes. He says they're private people, and he expects them to respect that privacy by not going anywhere that they're not invited. Gee, I wonder if they're going to go anywhere where they're not invited.
I will say, the only bright side, he sets up rules right here. He lays down the... This goes through some very obvious but very classic slasher tropes, and he sets up the rules, and if you break the rules, bad things are going to happen to you. Like, it's very A to B.
They go to the spare room, and Allie gives a scenario that she thinks this old hermit bought a Russian wife off the internet, and she came here not knowing what she was getting into. While Tim admits that she gave him a reach around, as well as the bed seduction. Dude, why are you telling her about this? What the fuck?
Yeah, she's going to become the first lady with a resume like that.
Oh my god, why are you opening this fucking can of worms? Jesus Christ.
Yes, but you're just flat out telling your Oh my god. Some of these lines, some of this just feels like they ran a camera and were like, improv, and go.
Tim says he thinks he's making videos and porn of stranded motorists, which explains the video cameras. Allie then gets up to use the outhouse because she drank all that iced tea. As she walks around, she goes into the porta potty. She sits down and then exits, and as she exits, she hears voices and scratching. She walks further into the woods, not a good idea, and then goes into another shed just as a preacher comes out of the house. She walks further in and sees religious artifacts as visions take shape. Again, we're setting things up here. I kind of liked where we were going with this.
We're setting things up. So, yes, obviously there's something here, there's something hidden. You know, you get a little bit of, ooh, I'm sure this is going to play a role by the end of the film. Don't set something up if you're not going to use it. So I'm intrigued by where it's going, but I got to say, this looks bad. It's paced bad. The acting is bad, but you got some ideas of what's going on. But also, it doesn't make any sense based on what they're shooting from the outside and then when they go to the inside. So, I mean, it's crappy, but you at least have the potential for a direct-to-video ninth installment of giving me something different. But you got to actually then give me something that you show me earlier in the film.
Correct, but after the doldrums of Isaac's return and revelation, I was kind of liking what we were getting here. I mean, this is one of those typical couples you do see in these slasher films. I don't remember if anyone remembers like a horror film that came out around this time called Rest Stop.
That's exactly what this looks like, even the...
Yeah.
But my notes say Cabin in the Valley, because yes, this makes me think of Southern California anywhere. Folks, no, it doesn't. This film looks like the poster for Rest Stop.
Yeah, or Wrong Turn 7.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I had to cover those Wrong Turn movies. Ugh.
No. No.
No, I said I had to cover them when I worked at a previous place. No, we're not going to cover those movies. The preacher walks around as she exits the shed and hears more voices coming from a trailer down the way. She walks in with mud and broken glass before cracking the door open and seeing a kid peek around before the door slams shut. She hides as the preacher approaches and then walks back to the shed and preaches as she gets back into the house and she unleashes to Tim about all that she just saw. So I like that one of this couple, not both of them, saw this and the other one is kind of having to deal with what she reports back, and of course she's not going to be believed. I'm liking where this is going. Again, at this point I'm pretty damn intrigued.
Bored, no. Intrigued, no. I'm just watching and waiting for the other shoe to drop.
You have zero confidence in this franchise to deliver, don't you?
Have you seen the precedent?
She says that they need to go tonight and take the kid with them. He brings up that she said bears attacked her one time, but they turned out to be squirrels, which I love that line. Tim asks if she actually saw the crying kid that she says that she saw, and she hates that he doubts her. He goes out and says he'll take out the preacher if he has to, since he took a judo class in high school.
Yeah, that's like the balls.
I know that guy.
I think Adam and I went to high school with this guy.
Still talks about that judo class.
Yeah, that's like the equivalent of mall karate.
Tim checks the camera and sees some unclear images as the bloody feet of Allie comes in and he kneels by the door. She walks in and he's holding the camera. The preacher approaches the house as Tim picks up the phone to call the police. Allie tells the preacher that she needs lights because she's scared to go out there by herself. And he gets out of her that she was in fact out once, but not by the shed. And he twirls her hair and pulls her close, saying that he told her not to sneak around. So we have some suspense going on here. Again, I'm having a better time with this than I did with Revelations. That's the precedent. Preacher then approaches Tim, who says that he just wants to get through the night, and he won't say a thing about what they saw if he just lets the kid go. So we have two differences of opinion here, right, guys? I mean, when we meet this couple, they seem like they're kind of in love and they're going to be having a family, but they're really on different ends of where we're going here, and it's... I'm liking this.
I would if I liked any of the interactions between them, but I'm kind of confused by everybody. You know, the young couple coming in, I don't get completely what's going on with them. And then with Preacher and Hostel, I don't understand exactly what's going on. So, no, I don't like it, because as much as I'm down for intrigue, this isn't interestingly done enough for me to be excited. You know, the only thing I'm thinking at this point when Preacher starts breaking down what's happening is I think he's supposed to be Soldier Boy from the opening.
Okay.
I get the feeling that he survived and that's why he's kind of a recluse into all this. Is I think that's what it's trying to tell me. But I think this movie is really confused as to who and what and why and everything. I think it's trying to be everything through the entire Korn mythos, and I think it lands none of it by trying to explore.
Yeah, I think perspective is the movie's biggest problem. Specifically like POV, and it also seems confused as to, is this part of the lineage or is it not? Because it doesn't really operate under a lot of the same rules. Not that they're consistent, but I'm not overly enthused about where it's going. But like I said, I'm not hating it.
But I will tell you, yeah, it's got a couple cool shots, you know. But the problem is then it lingers. It takes the dude 10 minutes and he still can't get that freaking camera back on the tripod. It's suspenseful for 30 seconds, but it keeps going. The little bloody footprints and the handprints, it's kind of cool, but even that doesn't go anywhere.
He says that he's actually getting rid of evil, and Helen's real name is Oksana, and she deceived him, as she didn't tell him that she was pregnant, and she just wanted her son to be born on American soil.
Yeah, I think I met her, too.
But he has forgiven her deceit, as he's from Gatlin, Nebraska, so the unspeakable things children do is forgiven. All this while flashes happen, and Tim and Allie, they hold hands. He tells about every adult in Gatlin being slaughtered by children. Now, what would make a child do something like that? Right after Preacher catches Allie trying to use the phone, Preacher tells Tim that it looks like you have a deceitful wife as well. So he's making the comparisons between him and this Russian chick and then these two, and they're not really favorable comparisons. Allie just wants to go, and Tim says that they have nowhere to go, and Preacher says that they never listen, as all efforts to leave the house are to no avail, as they can't get out. Allie says someone in the house has serious psychokinesis, and it could be someone they don't know about yet.
I can't believe that's where this went.
I know, man.
This turned into David from X-Men 2 out of nowhere.
Preacher says he wants the deceitful wife and cheating husband to return to bed, and then says that he hopes it'll release them at dawn. Allie starts crying and accuses Tim of fucking Helen, and he responds with he told her what happened, and all they have is each other at this point. Again, bro, why did you tell her? Jesus Christ.
See, but even this. Okay, this is when I start to really turn on this movie hard and quick, because at some point I'm like, hey, I'm not hating it. But it keeps teasing did it happen or not, and it doesn't tell you. Because you start getting the feelings that maybe he did, maybe he didn't. And are these visions, are they coming from somewhere? Is she tied into this? Because again, that's telling us that this is Genesis. You know, so either this is starting something new or it's the beginning of it all. But everything is just, it's not even teased in a fun way. It's just half-assed ideas that they just throw up here.
Allie just has visions of them fucking. And when Tim fights back, she goes back first right into the wall. We then see an image of Allie standing up amongst greenery and a little girl who runs away from her. As Allie chases her, she finds a little boy with an axe. Her hair is then pulled and she is sliced a few times no matter where she goes. She lays down and then sees the image of another little girl approaching before she is dragged off and hung on a corn-infused cross before waking up. More nightmares. How many times have we discussed in this series, boys? these nightmares. I think this began in number 4, where so many of them, and here we have another one. Take a shot every time there's a nightmare.
No, because I don't want to die.
Tim is sitting on a chair as they look out the window and see the police approaching. They're shouting from in the room, but the X-File-style flashlight this cop is carrying is preventing him from seeing them. The cop is then ejected into the air as his flashlight falls to the ground. This was hilarious. The best part is, of all parts of this movie that don't have a payoff, this fucking has a payoff at the end. Tim's trying to figure out if they're having visions or what is really going on or if they are dreaming the entire situation.
So are we.
Tim brings up talking to Helen, which Allie takes the mantle of doing. Preacher says Tim's just making it angry as Helen exits the room. So Tim's distracting Preacher, who says that they're like seeds floating in the air, and it is just growing inside of him. Allie then asks Helen about the boy in the shed, and Helen says that her husband isn't a man of God, and that he brought her here to have her bear his child. And it wasn't Preacher who locked him up, it was Helen herself to protect him from her husband. It wasn't her son, it was Preacher. Swerve, bro!
I got nothing.
I don't know. Everybody's got it. This is the worst Rashomon ever.
So we're getting He Who Walks Among the Rose. Preacher then says that he sees things like Allie's abortion after her first pregnancy because she was unsure of Tim. So we're getting, of course, two different stories here. Allie's pregnancy is a seed that He Who Walks Behind the Rose wants, as what he needs the most are children. Preacher then says the way to get out of the house is when it's asleep, which they won't know. They'll only know when it's awake. Tim tells Allie to not lean against the door, and then he asks if she actually had a miscarriage, but the subject's dropped. We see the delivery guy show up, and this guy, I was shocked to see this guy. He had gone from working with Nolan to doing this, because if you remember, this guy was in Memento. He sees the cop car and delivers some boxes, which is zucchini and a car set. Oh boy, this car set. Delivery guy then says that he'll give the kids a lift to Burleson's, and then he asks about the police car to no answer. The two come out of the house, and Tim stops, saying that he doesn't like the feeling he has about this. He then tells Pritchett that he appreciates him helping them out, but they don't like the idea of one riding in the back. They think about jumping into the police car, but Pritchett doesn't recommend this. But Tim starts it up and starts driving away, and Pritchett says that that takes care of their police problem. Helen brings her kid the car set and tells him not to be angry with her, as she's going to take him away from all this very soon. Oh boy. Tim and Allie, they wonder what happened back there, and Tim's convinced that it was a cult. Meanwhile, Helen's sliced in the background, and Allie wonders what was real and what wasn't, including what really happened between Tim and Helen. But she forgives Tim for what they did, and then you talk about a scene that doesn't belong in this movie.
Oh.
You know the best part about this?
No, please tell me.
That I recognized it?
Yes. And where did you recognize it from, Adam?
Isn't it Bad Boys 2?
It is Bad Boys 2.
It's the bridge scene.
Yes. They took footage from Bad Boys 2 and injected it in the scene in Children of the Corn Genesis. Matt, did you catch that?
Yeah, and I facepalmed. I did the facepalm. It was so mad. Like, first of all, the fact that they did that is just baffling. But also, that movie was like almost 10 years old by the time this came out.
Yes. Oh my god, I just love the fact that we have a car chase in a Children of the Corn movie, and it's not even its own car chase. They just took it from Michael Bay.
I mean, it makes as much sense as as soon as they just decided that nothing made sense, I guess this fits the theme.
Allie convinces Tim to go around the car as the kid topples cars off and causes the cars to come off the truck. Yes, this is real. A kid playing with a little car set is causing this fucking melee. One hits them and they get in a massive accident. Allie wakes up and sees that Tim is now dead. Pritchett opens the door and says that he's going to get her out and fixed up. He then apologizes for her loss, as it looks like Tim's in the arms of Jesus. We cut to Allie in the passenger seat of Pritchett's car as he lets her out and leads her to the preacher's house. She joins the other women of the cult, and she finds a little boy to sit next to and hold. We see her rock him to sleep with a close-up of her bloody face. The boy then grabs a corn stalk. You didn't think we wouldn't have corn here, boys. And drops it, which causes the cop's corpse to fall from the sky as credits roll on Children of the Corn, Genesis.
Yeah, shut that book closed.
Oh, what a fucking ending. Oh, my God. I I'll save it for my wrap-up. Scale of 1 to 10, what do we give Children of the Corn, Genesis? You boys were very quiet at the end of this review. I'm curious to know your thoughts. Adam?
Majority of this film, it's interestingly done enough that you don't really know what's going on, the who, the what, the where. It's in a different place with this little cabin in the wood, cabin in the desert feel. And as much as it makes no sense, you get the idea that something is growing. It doesn't. Every idea that is planted in this ground doesn't come to fruition. There's nothing to sow by the end of this. The stock do not shoot up out of the ground. They're confused as to what this movie was supposed to be, and it is there on screen. There's some not horrible performances. Put that on the poster. And, you know, that's about the only thing that you can say. But by the time that you get set up for the reveals by the end of this movie, there aren't any. You know what? Maybe Genesis is the right, you know, subtitle for this, because much like the Bible, this thing is full of contradictions and excuses and ideas that just don't come to fruition by the end of it. And that's a shame, because you could have done something kind of cool, but in the end, you're left going, why did you set this up? Why did you set that up? What does this mean? What about this double speak? And this movie doesn't close any of the loops that it sets up throughout the course of this film. I gotta say, though, I like it better than Revelation, so only for that, I'm gonna give it a 2.5, but man, this thing is so fucking confusing by the end of this that it's, I'm glad this was not the genesis of something new. So 2.5, because I gotta say I like it more than Revelation, but close the book on this, to Matt's point.
You must hate it, because you never give out 0.5s. All right, Goudreau, what you say, sir?
Well, if you want to know why I was so quiet, the last 20 to 25 minutes of this movie speaks for itself. I mean, when you bring Michael Bay into a Children of the Corn movie, and I become violently ill like The Exorcist, as someone who loves Bad Boys 2, I don't even know what else to say. I kind of wish there was a commentary track for this movie so I could understand what was going through the director's mind, because this one feels stitched together more than any of the others, as far as they have the genesis of a million ideas, couldn't come up with a central stock to put everything together, and as a result, it's disjointed and not unwatchable, though. That's the one compliment I'll give. Put this on the poster. It's not unwatchable. But at the same time, the stuff that's here is kind of predictable as far as how it ends, and look, we got voodoo in this, we got possession, we got all kinds of shit. So, as far as this series, it's not the worst one, so I guess I'll give it a 3.
All right, a 3 from Goudreau. You know, after Donna B. Borchers last week decided to remake the first film, I'd be curious to interview Joel Sasson to ask him why he decided to go back to the type of doldrums and material that weighed down Revelations and Isaac's Return. The only thing I could think of is something we've mentioned before, maybe to a high extent, is that this feels like a reworked script. This feels like something Sasson had in his head and was like, you know what? I'm a producer of this franchise. I want to get my story on screen. I am just going to make this into a Children of the Corn film. I will say, I don't think this reaches the low of the lows that we've seen in this series. I think there are good things here. Yes, I said good. I think the way things are set up, I was with this couple. Again, I go back to Rest Stop, a movie that I haven't seen since it was out, but I remember kind of enjoying at the time. Haven't revisited it, but I was intrigued by what they were doing here. But what they end up with by the end is ridiculous, and I'm sorry. Another reason I would love to interview Sasson is to find out why he decided to just infuse Bad Boys 2 footage in a Children of the Corn movie with the huge amount of effects and the sound and everything else that come with a Bay chase scene being put in a Children of the Corn. That just fascinates me to no end. And to see this kid move these cars as they're toppling off this right in front of them is insane. And I just love the balls it takes to do that. All that being said, though, the last 20 minutes of this is a bit of a mess. The fact that she ends up in this cult, okay. I like the idea of a horror film ending on a bad note. Horror films aren't supposed to make you feel good, I don't think, if they're done in a way that makes you feel something. I think if you do this, you have to feel for the character. And by the end, I just didn't feel for this girl. So, better than Revelations? Yes. But that's not a real high bar. I will go with a 3.5. I will also bust out of 0.5. Is it watchable? Yes, but I would probably not watch it again after watching it for this particular retrospective. I do recommend that if people like horror, it has a different take on it, and maybe there could be some intrigue. All right, that's Children of the Corn Genesis. Next week, we go to Children of the Corn Runaway. Adam, any expectations for next week?
I was hoping that it was a documentary on the classic Jon Bon Jovi hit, but I guess it's not. So, nothing. Nothing. I don't know. Maybe somebody that escapes a cult. Fuck. I have no idea.
Or a documentary on a Michael Crichton film starring Tom Selleck. Matt, what about you, sir? What do you have expectations for next week?
I think that subtitle is a warning and a premonition, not necessarily connected to the movie. So I'm hoping, I'm doing my jet logic. Expect the worst, hope for the worst.
I'll say this. I saw this particular one when it was out, when it was originally released, and I remember really digging it. Take that for what it is. But I have expectations for next week that are probably too high for this particular retrospective. But until next time, when we discuss Children of the Corn Runaway, what hath the podcast commandeth? Thank you, boys.
We must sacrifice them both tonight.
Amos was satisfied. We need the woman. She'll bring the man to us.
No. He must be taken without her. We cannot remove her from this place. It is holy.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Why don't you put that in your gut and smoke it?
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Question not my judgment, Malachi. I am the giver of his word.
And keep coming back, as the boys will continue going through the works of Stephen King in publication order.
He wants you too, Malachi.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice. It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
You guys all belong in an asylum somewhere, loony bin. Where are your parents?
And if you like this review, please head over to percolatedmedia.net or search your podcast streamer of choice, where we have individual reviews such as Knock at the Cabin, The Black Phone, Megan, as well as additional blockbuster franchises like the Mad Max movies, Avatar, the Planet of the Apes franchise, Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
You are a sinner. You are the fire of the corn. It will do you no good to curse me.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
You know not the laws. He speaks them only to me.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Assuming that it's ever stopped.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
You know, if you're gonna keep visiting Isaac, it's probably something you should know. It's a small town. People are gonna talk.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
But you've come back to us.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
That'll make us just like them.
The Freeman and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
There ain't nothing out there, Mordecai, except a lot of corn. Stupid old corn.
See you around.
Matt, you mentioned when we covered one of the previous films that you were dreading the name Billy Drago. Well, here he is. Was that what was really getting you to think, you know what, this isn't going to be a good time? Matt? Are you there? Hello?
Sorry, my mute button got stuck.
Okay. I was like, wait a second, did my thing go out?
No, you're fine.
Okay.
What was the question?
You said previously that you were...
This is the end!